This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. Wow, you regular listeners, it has been a while, hasn't it? Thank you very much for your patience. I think we will make up for that with today's episode, which I'm very excited about, honestly. Sarah Thornton is the guest of honor. She is an art world ethnographer, and in that sense, if among others, I can't think of a more ideal guest for this show, since I am interested in the inner workings of the art world, among other things, the psychology of the people within it. And I think she gets quite deeply into those things in her books, which, if you're not familiar with her and her work, she is most known for first 7 days in the art world, and then much more recently, 33 artists in three acts. And she is also a art reporter, if that's the right term, for The Economist. I'm excited about this one. I do want to offer you a very important introduction to the episode before we dive in. And that is that, in the interest of full disclosure, I listened to the audiobooks of both 7 days and 33 artists that were provided to me by Sarah, which I am grateful for. I don't think you can overestimate how crucial that consuming experience is, listening to the audiobook versus reading the books. Tavia Gilbert, who is a great reader or narrator of both books, has quite an interesting voice and really brings these scenes alive, if that doesn't sound like too much of a sales pitch slash cliche. But the reason I say all that is because the way that I structured our conversation, the conversation between Sarah and I, is by listening to these two books, I looked back and remembered certain moments that stuck out. And we ended up spending quite a bit of time on two of the most well-known artists in the art world, which seems like overkill maybe in a sense. But what I was actually most interested in was the way that her dynamic in these scenes with these artists and how much that came alive and how much I could sympathize and, or perhaps even empathize with her in those situations. And so that's why we ended up doing that. So I wanted you to be aware of that ahead of time. And it's not a defense. I'm not apologizing for it. It's an important caveat to the conversation that we end up having. We do talk about other people too, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that was pretty much it as far as the introduction. Finally, before we get there, I wanted to remind you that there is no advertising for this episode. It feels like maybe there could be, because it's going to be a big one. And in fact, there is no corporate sponsorship. This is a listener-supported show, and there is no support if there are no listeners supporting. So I just want to take a second and remind you that you can donate to the show of any amount that you choose via the website, theconversationpod.com. Thank you very much in advance if you are so inclined. And I will talk to you a little bit more on the back end. We'll see what we think by then. I hope you enjoy this. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Not bad at all.
When you and I spoke initially, I had made the presumption about the two books that I had not read yet at that time, that you perhaps had a thick skin, and you told me that I would find out otherwise when I read them. And I, now that I've consumed them, I listened to them, did not read them per se, but there's a little ambivalence there. There are a couple of moments here and there where that seems to be the case, but I don't think it's obvious that you don't have a thick skin or you have a thin skin. I just wanted to see what your thoughts on that are.
Well, what do you mean by a thick skin?
Well, good question. I think the presumption, especially on behalf of a lot of artists, is that when you sort of dive deeply into all those arenas of the art world, you know, that you're made to be insecure in a lot of different ways. And so I think it's kind of coming from that perspective.
Well, I mean, I think that different people have different affinities for different kinds of research. And I like doing interactive research in real time with real people. I studied art history as an undergraduate and loved it, but I don't think I'd be happy sitting in an archive just interacting with documents. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm a thick-skinned socialite or something like that, or
right.
that I find social circumstances to be easy. I actually often joke that I became a sociologist because the only way I could cope with the social world was by analyzing it and
mm-hmm.
kind of objectifying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that's true. So I don't think I have particularly thick skin or necessarily thin skin. I'm a professional. I'm a professional ethnographer. And my training means that I have, you know, studied ways of gaining access, interviewing, doing participant observation, moving through a social world, not like a true participant, really, but a professional quasi-participant.
Where did you get that training? And how hands-on was it, or was this something you had to learn on your own?
I did a PhD with a sociologist of music called Simon Frith, and in the course of doing it, I basically trained myself to be an ethnographer.
Mm-hmm.
And ethnography comes out of anthropology. It was devised as a kind of non-judgmental way for, you know, principally in the 19th century anyway, white Westerners to kind of, you know, go into tribal situations and come to understand their culture. And so it was imported into sociology in the early 20th century as a means by which people could study, you know, urban culture. And so that's the kind of ethnography that I was trained up in. It's often called Chicago School of Sociology, you know, the Chicago School of Sociology, a certain kind of qualitative sociology that uses ethnography as its primary form of research.
Does that? But I'm wondering how that translates to being at an art fair and maneuvering, you know, between the various factions, being at the auction and doing, you know, similar, being at openings. Generally, I mean, I can't imagine this music mentor you had a lot to say about what you were going to do in those situations.
Well, I did my PhD on dance clubs and raves, and so there can be a lot of cliquey factions between you know, music people with different musical tastes. And a lot of antagonism, actually,
mm-hmm.
and disdain for each other,
mm-hmm.
Which is not unlike the kind of disdain different subcultures of the art world can have for
right.
each other.
Right.
You know, both are involved in different kind of taste wars, you could say,
mm-hmm.
Or belief wars,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of, like, what they value. And so one of the things you learn as an ethnographer, in a way, is not to get kind of sucked into the factions, and to try to be a nonpartisan.
Well, that's an interesting juncture to look at, because I'm interested in the way that you know, initially, you don't have a calling card per se, and that's something that we can look at too, how you sort of gradually grow one throughout the two books. But being sort of the social ethnographer label implies that you're sort of coming into this other culture and, you know, sort of documenting it, observing and documenting it. But yet throughout, you are enmeshed in it to a certain degree. You know, you're hanging out with these people extensively. So how, you know, where is the, is there a navigate?
The degree to which I'm an outsider and an insider varies between the two books. So in 7 Days in the Art World, I actually, when I started doing the research, I was very much an outsider to the art world. I'd done a degree in art history like 10 years previously, but I had a few girlfriends who I'd studied art history with who'd become curators, but I didn't know any dealers or collectors. I knew some artists, but not necessarily ones who were well-recognized. And so in the course of researching 7 Days in the Art World, I perhaps became a little bit more of an insider as I got to know people, but I think I still very much had an outsider's hat on. By the time I got around to writing 33 Artists in 3 Acts, I think I was very much more an insider. People knew me through 7 Days in the Art World, which actually became a very good calling card. People who'd read the book understood where I was coming from and were more likely to give me the kind of interview I wanted, mm-hmm. more likely not to be thrown by the kinds of questions I was asking.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I had, upon finishing 7 Days in the Art World, I started writing for The Economist, and that became another kind of calling card. People who perhaps might not have wanted to give me more than one interview for 33 Artists and 3 Acts eventually gave me 2, 3, or 4 interviews, partly because I was reporting for The Economist at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that although I was an insider in certain ways by the time I got to writing 33 Artists and 3 Acts, there were two things that made me feel like I still had at least one foot on the outside. And one was writing for The Economist because it is a magazine that is not for art world people. I had to write about everything and always think about everything in terms that would make sense to, like, well-educated people, but people who have no background necessarily in art. And it's also a very plain-speaking global magazine, so I even had to write for, you know, a lot of readers for whom English is their second language. You know, we have the bulk of the readership is in North America, but we have huge readerships in Europe and Hong Kong. And
to what extent is the tone that you use for The Economist?
Sorry, can I just finish? Because then there's two. Just the second, the other reason why I kind of felt like an outsider is because I was so much focusing on artists. I think that each artist has almost got their own orbit and their own world, and although I might have been an insider in some part of the art world, I wasn't necessarily an insider into their particular worlds. And, mm-hmm. you know, often the higher an artist rises, the larger the kind of orbit around them can
right.
be.
Right, right.
Sorry.
I can put that aside because what you're making me ask now is, in what situations did you feel the most outsider? I mean, you just referred to being these, you know, these outer orbits, like, you know, the when you did the Jeff Koons one-on-one or the Damien Hirst with a bunch of other reporters, are those the kinds of what kind of situations did you sort of feel the most self-conscious?
I think with 33 Artists and 3 Acts, definitely you've hit both right on the nose. Koons and Hirst, in various different ways, made me very much feel like an outsider. I mean, Koons, he's kind of on his own planet, actually. I mean, he in the end, he was very generous to me. He was very tolerant, but he also kind of didn't budge, or didn't budge that much to my line of questioning, seems to be, you know, live in his own ecosystem. Similarly with Hirst.
Right.
I mean, Hirst more overtly was antagonistic towards me and wanted to literally keep me outside. But, yeah, so I'd say... you know, I had a kind of more profound sense of identification, let's say, with someone like Ai Weiwei, who operates in quite a different way, or with Carol Dunham and Laurie Simmons, who were very open with me.
And you documented your sort of hanging out with them at the Biennale. But back to Hearst, before we get back to Koons, there was a little bit of an edge of flirting going on. So in addition to him sort of being antagonistic, was there some weird flirtatious element as well?
No.
Okay. So that was my misreading,
huh?
Yeah,
I guess
so.
Maybe the audiobook reads it that way because...
Right.
The very first interview I ever did with him back in about 2004, which I do recount in a paragraph or two, was not flirtatious on my part, but could have been construed as flirtatious or just weird on his part, because he insisted on doing the interview in his bedroom.
That's what I was imagining.
And so that first interview... like, I don't know, 11 years ago or whenever it was weird. I don't think it was really flirtatious. It was like more like a test for me. Mm. And, you know, his partner, his then partner was downstairs. They had three kids. We all went to lunch together. He did call me drunkenly in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But again, it was mostly just drunken,
okay.
You know? Subsequent to that first meeting, there was no flirtation at all. I mean, Koons is way more flirtatious. Koons is kind of has that mode. And the first time I went to his studio, it did feel a little bit flirtatious. I mean, I think a lot of very, very many parts of the art world, you know, there's a fine line between being charming and being flirtatious, and it's kind of hard. It doesn't really have to be at all sexual, but it can
right.
feel a bit flirty.
Did it work on you?
Well, you know, I'm trying to think back. I don't think so. what do you say? I mean, I guess you've listened to the audiobook, which will give a different take, slightly different voice to the
Definitely.
Written text.
Yeah.
And, you know, I live with my girlfriend in San Francisco. And I believe that the lovely woman who did the audiobook is straight. I don't know if that gives it a slightly different flavor. Or if she, you know, embodied the book in a slightly different way.
So you weren't in on directing those audio recording sessions then, I take it?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that.
They gave me a choice of a few different readers,
mm-hmm.
and I chose her on the basis of other things she'd read,
mm-hmm.
partly based
mm-hmm.
on her accent, which
yeah.
was... because there were a few of the other ones were a little southern,
right?
And I'm from Canada, and Tavia is from like northeast coast. She didn't, you know, like I can't remember. She's from Vermont or Maine. You know, her accent was like more like mine
right,
as
right.
a Montrealer than someone who was from Alabama or something like that.
Right.
And also, she had a lot of energy in her voice. And there were other things I liked about her reading, but I haven't actually listened to my own books tape.
We'll have a follow-up conversation after you do.
And rewritten them many times. So this is the first bit of feedback I've had on them. So
well, regardless of the audio book element, I mean, I'm sure if I read the text, there would be a very ambiguous dynamic with Damien Hirst, you know, the antagonism and this sort of flirty-esque sort of element. So, I mean, why was he antagonistic to you, do you think?
Oh, well, I know exactly why.
Mm.
And I do write about it in the final scene with him in Act 3. Basically, I wrote a piece on his market in The Economist back in September 2010, which was like an autopsy of his Beautiful Inside My Head Forever, Sotheby's sale, which had made a huge amount of money on the very same night as Lehman Brothers collapsed. And it was a great mystery to everyone in the auction room as to how it could have made so much money. So I researched that auction for 2 years and wrote a pretty meticulous, factually accurate piece on what had happened to his market since that auction. And The Economist had given it the subtitle, How Hearst Grew Rich at the Expense of His Investors. Mm-hmm. And the piece had gone viral, and strangely, it became at that time the article with the most number of hits on the Economist website ever, which is quite something for an art piece.
Yes,
and so I think probably very few of Hearst's investors, so to speak, weren't aware of the piece. And at that point, I was kind of cut off. Access to him. I no longer given any interviews until I managed to get one in Doha.
Well, you really, if you do ever listen to the audiobook, I think it's one of the more memorable moments is, I guess, somewhere after that point that you're referring to, when you're going to some large press gathering for him, and he looks over everybody and sees you, and he kind of goes, "Hi," to that effect. Is that about right?
That's exactly what happened. I mean, it was really weird.
Yeah,
very weird. So, there was a lot of passive aggression, or just pure aggression.
Right,
but not so passive, kind of active aggression, I guess you could call it. And he was not happy with me.
We could go on about Hearst for quite a while, but I want to go back to Koons, because I think one of the most memorable moments of both books for me is when you're in there alone, presumably with him in that interview room, and before the press woman comes in and stops you. But there's just something about the atmosphere that's captured there that's really profound, and I'm just going to briefly quote from that scene. You say to him, "I'm familiar with your favorite adages and anecdotes, so it would be great if you could resist your penchant for reiterating them and answer my questions directly," which was a bold beginning. And then you go on to say, compare him to a politician who doesn't want to lose votes. But then at one point he offers an uncharacteristically straight answer in which he says, "I don't believe I am a conservative," explaining that he accepts everything. But that's just to give people a little bit of a sketch if they haven't read it. But I'm just really interested in what it was, what it's like being alone with him in a room, without sort of all of the orbiting that's going on.
I mean, he's a pretty amazing guy, incredibly polite and charming, but also kind of Teflon coated and very hard to penetrate, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I'm glad you picked out that moment, because for me, it is the kind of like climax of that scene. And the climax of a lot of going back and forth trying to, get some juice out of him, which isn't, over homogenized.
Right.
And, he tried. I do feel like he tried to answer my questions in my terms. It was not easy for him.
Right.
He thinks within his own terms.
Right.
And he is not someone who, like Gabriel Orozco or, Carol Dunham, who's like, can take my questions and savor them and really think in my terms.
Yeah.
And so, he did try, and he, it was an act of generosity on his part. I mean, at the time I was also writing for both Artform and The Economist, so, you know, I guess he felt like it was in his interest to do as well as he could for me. I often multitasked the book with The Economist, and in that case, the book with The Economist and Art Forum. So he probably wouldn't have talked to me again just for the book, because I was clearly a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's one of those professionals who... and actually probably way more professional than Hearst, who
Sure.
kind of, like, took things very personally and got angry and tempestuous.
But in comparison, if you're going to make that comparison, couldn't you say that Hearst at least has a heart, whereas Kuntz, it's not really clear if he does, in a sense, if you know where I'm going with that?
I do know what you're going with that. I mean, also, the thing I admire about Hearst is the degree to which he's a risk taker, and he'll just, like, take massive risks with his market, and which he did, and which is the reason why it's in the toilet now. He threw away his market, whereas Kuntz is a very, much more conservative personality, and probably also politically.
You think he is potentially a real conservative, it sounds like.
Sorry, say again?
Yeah, I just said you really do probably think he's politically conservative.
Well, I mean, I think he's, who knows? Who knows is not entirely clear.
Yeah.
He's a libertarian, let's put it that way. So you can have libertarians on the right and libertarians on the left. I would say one of the reasons he's not keen on talking politics is he knows that the general sensibility of curators and critics in the art world is on the left.
Yeah.
And he knows he will alienate them.
Right.
And he's had trouble with that in the past as the kind of stockbroker artist. So I think there's a moment in an earlier scene where he talks about how the reason he doesn't want to talk about politics is he doesn't want to do anything that might hurt his work, you know, and I think what he means is hurt the reception of his work.
Yeah, right.
And so that's pretty strategic self-censorship, which is one of the reasons I contrast him with Ai Weiwei the way the 33 Artists and Three Acts, you know, you have these antagonistic pairings. And so Kuntz and Ai Weiwei become the foils for each other in Act One.
Yeah,
whose title is politics, and it's really through the way the reader can compare and contrast their different styles with regard to power and politics that comes through.
Another really memorable moment, also involving Kuntz, although to a lesser extent, is. You're going to have to help me with the exact event, but it was either in Switzerland or Germany when you did a talk with Jeff Kuntz and Larry Gagosian?
I was in Abu Dhabi.
Oh, Abu Dhabi. Okay.
Yeah. I was interviewing the pair of them in Abu Dhabi.
Now, is that incredibly rare, as one would expect, that Gagosian would, you know, even though it's not a press thing per se, that he would be involved in a talk?
I think Larry does them rarely, and I think the reason he did it was precisely because it was in Abu Dhabi. They're an important key client and potential client, and so, you know, there's got to be a lot of potential money on the line for him to give a talk.
Right.
And I think initially it was supposed to be both Larry and I, and then Larry brought in Kuntz.
So,
as a way to deflect attention from himself.
Yes.
And I couldn't believe my luck. I thought, wow.
You know,
I would never have been able to interview the pair of them together myself.
Right.
And it was set up for me. I was thrilled. And it allowed me to... I structured the whole interview around asking them about their relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I'm really interested in as a sociologist of the art world is the relationship between artists and dealers and artists and curators and artists with each other. And that's one of the themes that runs through both 7 days in the art world and 33 hours in 3 acts.
Well, so the moment that I wanted to get to from that, which is another one of the more memorable moments of both books, hopefully, and are anticipating where I'm going with this, a woman in the crowd, in the audience, I don't remember the lead up to her final question, but it was, is it lonely at the top? Right? And you're going to have to help me with whatever Jeff said. I think it was something pretty forgettable. But then Larry said, I've never been lonely.
Yeah.
And that was just, you know, that was just a perfect Gagosian answer, wasn't it? And I mean, I'm interested in what kind of person who already is at the top and has so much actually sort of has to make a preemptively defensive comment like that.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't know. You can interpret that in so many different ways. I think Larry is a personality. My impression is that he is a highly self-sufficient person. He is not emotionally needy. And he's also surrounded by a team of helpers. So he is not alone physically, and he is not inclined to be emotionally lonely. So my feeling with that is actually on that particular occasion, he's just speaking his mind. And I'm looking at that paragraph. Koons's is one of those kind of waffly Koonsian answers.
Right.
About I've always just wanted to participate, just wanted to be part of the dialogue. I wanted
right.
to be a continuation of the avant-garde. In New York, if you participate, the ball is thrown to you. You know, of course, most artists don't feel necessarily the ball was thrown to them. But I guess sometimes you just have to intercept the ball. I mean, one of my favorite parts of that scene is when one of the people in the audience kind of challenges Koons about whether he's really a creative if he's not making his own work.
Oh, yeah, uh-huh.
And he talks about this metaphor. He uses this metaphor and just says, well, he sees his assistants as an extension of his finger, which is just such a graphic image and metaphor. You know, you imagine, like, God's finger touching Adam or something.
Yeah.
And it's also such a great contrast to Ai Weiwei's form of delegation and collaboration with his assistants, because when he talks about his studio, he talks about it in a very democratic way, as, you know, we get together, we like talk about it, we go with the best idea, whereas Koons's model is way much more dictatorial. You know,
right.
They're an extension of my finger.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of details like that that run throughout the book, comparing and contrasting different artistic styles of being, basically.
I'm interested in, though, in that, you know, in addition to what we talked about, both Koons and Gagosian, that, you know, back to this thick skin, thin skin, somewhere in the middle model, what does it feel like, you know, being in their presence in that kind of situation? I mean, what did you leave that experience with? I mean, were you... how did it emotionally affect you?
That's a good question. I mean, I was fairly nervous going into on stage to interview Larry and Jeff.
Sure.
I don't feel like they're, neither of them necessarily natural buddies, you know what I mean? And so there's a fair amount of discomfort for me. But I was excited by the research opportunity and wanted to make the most of it.
Sure.
And I didn't want to get pat answers. That was my key thing. I didn't want a load of PR bullshit, which could easily have come out. So I kept it very specific about how they'd met, what their first, that kind of thing. And so I was very pleased with it in the end. And then also the audience was exceedingly useful, because it was not a particularly well-educated audience for contemporary art.
Right.
You know, there was a, you know, probably a lot of people in the audience who didn't think Marcel Duchamp's urinal was an artwork.
Right,
you know?
Right.
They were still in a kind of previous era a little bit. And so when you get those kinds of questions, those are often often very irritating to art world people, but important questions to hear others answer.
Right.
And so
they're doing your work for you to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to ask those questions because I share a sense of belief with them.
Right.
But, I mean, I'd love to talk about some of the other artists in the book.
I'm going to move on.
Well,
let me get, before we do, I want to get to, before we run out of time, I definitely want to get to another of the more memorable moments from the book, which is what you spend a lot of time at Miami, I believe, with David Teeger. Is that his name, the collector?
Actually, this was in 70s in the art world
in
at
Basel.
Art Basel in Switzerland.
Right. Sorry.
David Teeger is one of the collectors I shadow for part of that day.
Right, okay. So I would be remiss if we didn't cover this particular moment. So you talk about, as you walk around with him, because he has made you his companion for, or escort for a little while. He says the affection, you write, the affection between him and the dealers he encounters is quite quite prominent. And he introduces you by first and last name, and yet they obviously think you're his latest, you know. Well, you go on to say...
Acquisition,
is that the word you... Right. Well, at one point, you notice he's talking with a senior dealer, you say, and looking over at you, whispering in his ear with what you imagine to be saying, is she the latest addition to your collection?
That amused you.
Well, certainly it did. Yeah, of course.
I mean, David, bless him, he passed away last year. Was a much beloved character in the art world, a very much a ladies' man who, often had a beautiful younger woman on his arm and did have a girlfriend at that time, but also had, you know, loved the ladies. So I ended up, it doesn't matter who you are, you can be positioned structurally in that role. And that's what happens. You know, the David's reputation in that world superseded anybody who I might have been. And so as an ethnographer, you just kind of, that's another moment that I did not find particularly comfortable.
Yeah.
But as an ethnographer, you kind of sublimate your own emotional needs so that you can do the research. And so I learned quite a bit following him around him talking about what he bought that day, because actually, I think on that day, he'd even bought a Koons.
Mm.
So it's interesting. You're pulling out. You're really interested in flirtation because you're pulling out, perhaps like the sole reference to it, the only reference to it in 70s in the art world, and the only reference to it in 33 Arts and 3 Acts.
Well, I'll
telling me something about you.
Yes, you could certainly say that, but I'm going to slightly adjust that take, because what I'm interested in is that for me was one of the preeminent moments where, okay, maybe she doesn't have a thick skin, you know, this is and you really articulated it well what was going on there. On one hand, you were feeling sort of personally slighted or, you know, judged even, but at the same time you're saying, as an ethnographer, I understand that this is part of my work and I know it's just part of what I, you know, what I need to get through to get my work done.
Well, I just think that a good ethnographer is not thick-skinned because they have to be ultra-sensitive to the cultural and social nuances of what they're experiencing.
Right. Well said.
So that's probably why I reacted semi-negatively when you assumed
right.
that I was thick-skinned.
Okay, fair enough.
Months ago when we first spoke.
Fair enough. Well said. here, I'm gonna give you another artist. We're gonna get to a woman now because I know you're anxious to get away from all these, you know, these obvious men artists, and I am too actually. I just wanted to, those were just some memorable moments for me. So Martha Rosler, you know, who is. Certainly not a market-friendly artist like these other people we've been talking about. So I'm going to just recreate a moment that you have with her, which is one of, definitely the most memorable moment with Martha Rosler. Talking about propaganda, you basically tried to suggest to her that perhaps weak propaganda can make strong art, while strong propaganda maybe makes for lame art, at which point she challenges you, and you mentioned the expression that she doesn't suffer fools. And then she says, in turn, art and propaganda are ephemeral and have different definitions depending on their era and place. And then she, you write, the artist glowers at me, inviting a retort. She taught art at university full-time for 30 years, retiring in 2010. She is perhaps starved for an argument.
Yeah, I mean, she is cantankerous in a really wonderful way. Martha's it kind of the climax of Act Three. She comes in and really clears the air, actually removes, there's a lot of things floating, a lot of ambiguities, and in a way, Martha sees certain things in a very black and white way, which is a relief. And she's also has a very overt political position on the left, and she's argumentative. She wants to have the arguments, and so.
Did you enjoy the arguments, or was it more something to endure?
Say that again, sorry?
I said, did you enjoy those arguments?
Oh my God, I love them.
Okay,
I love them. I mean, absolutely. I mean, the for me, the worst kind of conversation is one that's full of euphemism and politeness, right?
Right?
I mean, that's
right.
The frustration of Coons.
Right.
And Martha calls a spade, and is not worried about being offensive or impolite or uncharming. I mean, she's great.
Yeah.
And I do feel like, truly, her scene, which is scene 15 of 17 scenes, in Act One is the climax, and then you have a Coons and a Hearst, Coons and an Ai Weiwei scene that come after, which are kind of denouement.
Mm. Yeah. Now, so the thing that when you talk, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to.
Well, like, I mean, I'm not worried about her. I'm like incredibly secure in my own intelligence, and so I. When people kind of, somebody treats me like I'm an idiot because I've asked a question like, what is an artist or something very basic like that.
Right.
Which of course Martha doesn't, but you know, I'm putting a counter argument, playing devil's advocate with her. And she is, you know, expressing some actually what I'd call exasperation for dramatic effect, you know, for all of that works for me. And also the great thing about being an ethnographer is like, it's all about the interaction and the research that's revealed and the quotes and what comes out of it. And, you know, if I'm revealed to be stupid on some front, then that's fantastic because that means we're all learning something.
That's very democratic of you. You made me think.
No, it's true. I mean, I think that I don't write memoirs. I write books about others,
right?
Where I really try to get into the perspective of others,
right?
You know, and so I just want to do anything I can to bring out the most intelligent insights out of my interviewees and out of my character.
Yes, and speaking of drawing out insights, the way you describe the love of argument and how you appreciate people having opinions, you know, as opposed to using euphemisms like Coons. So the Francesco Bonomis and others throughout both books there seems to be this theme of, you know, put downs, basically disses or sort of being very clear about opinion about other artists, you know, whether it's a curator or an artist on another artist. And I'm just wondering what your takeaway has been as to if that is done as a way to try to navigate the dialogue or herd the dialogue in some way, or if it's just people respect people who have strong opinions, or a combination of both, or what?
I mean, there are a lot of people in the world with weak opinions who don't want to speak their mind and don't want to go on the record. So I'm much more inclined to go for someone who's keen to speak their mind and has a very strong opinion. It's much more interesting, and it creates a dialogue of extremes in some instances. Benami is like a great writer and a great talker who has a fantastic sense of humor. And so, you know, he says things as jokes, but which are true, I guess, you know, in the Freudian sense of a joke.
Right.
I mean, one of my favorite lines in his scene is that, you know, curators are like butlers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you do a solo show, you're basically a butler. The artist chooses everything, he says.
Right.
You know, curator is not even a job. It's just something between an artist, a writer, and a butler. We are frustrated people.
Is Benami the one who did the bit about, you know, good real artists and bad real artists and whatnot? Does that ring
exactly
a bell? Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And I have to explain that the reason Benami's in the book is because Act Two is the theme is kinship. And so I pull in Francesco Benami and Massimiliano Gioni, who are brothers in crime with Maurizio Catalan.
Right.
And so, and both of them have been integral to Catalan's work in different ways. Benami has titled a lot of Catalan's works. And so, yeah. So anyway, yes, he does talk about, has his own taxonomy of real and fake.
It's just so judgmental, though, you know, even if it is the Freudian real, you know, it's just, and, you know, maybe it's kind of jokey, as you suggested, but I just, when there's a line when artists are just saying, you know, I don't like this person, and having a strong opinion, to really sort of being mean and kind of like, everybody sucks except for this one person who I'm promoting, you know?
Well, I mean, I think Benami is mostly being funny, and, you know, when he says they should put Ai Weiwei back in jail, I don't think he really means it.
Yeah. Okay.
I you know, and I don't think that, I don't think the characters in, or the artists and curators and others in 33 Artists and Three Acts are nasty, actually.
I just had this sense.
I mean, Benami is fairly bitchy about Catalan.
Okay.
But he obviously has, you know, great frustration at feeling that he's been his butler on occasion.
Yeah, sure.
And he wrote an unauthorized autobiography of Catalan, which is a very funny book, which is like a half fact, half fiction, short book in which he pretends to be Catalan.
Well, you mentioned Andrea Frazier earlier, and I definitely did want to get to her for sure, because I think she may be the hero of 33 Artists. And she's the one who says artists are part of the problem, you know, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem in that model.
Yeah.
And it seems that she is, if nothing else in both books, she's kind of the voice of the 99%, and that there is actually an economy out there that is crumbling outside of this bubble that is the art world throughout the books elsewhere. Did you see her as a way to reference, you know, life outside the bubble in a way?
Absolutely. I mean, Andrea, I think, is the ultimate hero of the book. I mean, there's a lot of them, but Andrea has the last word.
Exactly.
You know, she
exactly.
isn't the recurring character of Act Three, and she has the final scene in the book.
Right.
And she
and
says
it's
a
beautiful scene, by the way, for those who haven't read it.
Thank you so much. I'm proud of that scene. You know, she says a lot of things that I want someone to say. She has read a lot of Pierre Bourdieu, who's a French sociologist with whom I'm also extensively acquainted because he was instrumental to my thinking for my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is true. You know, artists are often presented as innocent victims of the art world, but actually they are agents in many, many ways. And being in touch with their agency is the best way of understanding their position in the art world. And that is kind of a key theme in the book and one that Andrea makes explicit. She's also, you know, so much of her work has been about artist roles and artist myths. And so, you know, I probably describe her work in more detail than almost anyone else's. I devote an entire scene to her performance, Official Welcome, where she goes between being an artist, about eight different artist types, which are often based on found dialogue, and eight or so different supporter types, museum directors, patrons, dealers and curators and collectors. And it's an incredibly insightful performance that she first did in 2001 and has redone various times over the years. The version that I document is one she did in Dusseldorf in 2009. But
I'm gonna say that for readers who are in any way involved in the art world, that a lot of the things she has to say is going to put people on the defensive, or at least check themselves, you know, as to what their role in the art world is. And further, though, I wonder if it was if you were aware of the fact that you're walking around with her in the sculpture garden outside the Broad, you know, building at UCLA, exactly, and I just couldn't help but wonder if there isn't a little bit of hypocrisy there, you know, in that she is, her living is being sustained by Broad, in a sense.
Well, you know, there's everyone has to make a living, and she works at UCLA, a state university, and does her best. You know, you know, there is no pure state into which we can retreat.
Right.
You know, like, you know, you have to drive a car when you live in L.A., you know.
Yeah.
You have to have a bank account.
Yeah.
You know, you can hate the banks, but what are you going to do without a bank account? You can't get paid. You know, I would say that Andrea is one of the least hypocritical people I know. She really tries very hard to think through her beliefs on all levels.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pleased for her and the students of UCLA that she has a job there.
Yeah, sure.
I think she's a remarkable thinker and probably a slightly scary teacher.
Yeah, I bet.
But I think that's good for students.
Sure.
You know, and
I think yeah. through your, I think.
Mean, I think she sees through a lot of the bullshit
right.
that it burdens artists' roles, and artists and others in the art world can learn a massive amount from her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that she doesn't have her own romance. You know, the thing I like about her is she kind of has an anti-romantic stance towards certain old romances, but her own romance with what it means to be an artist, which really comes out in the final scene where we meet in the midst of this amazing video installation she made called Projection, which is based on a performance in which she enacts both her therapist and herself, or a therapist and an artist. And so to see the artist in therapy kind of sobbing partly over, you know, guilt in relation to potential hypocrisies and guilt in relation to her success in relation as opposed to the lack of recognition that her mother, who aspired to be an artist, had and that kind of thing. I mean, it's a very intimate, very poignant video work, which allows me to have a more intimate look at the interiority and of being an artist.
You describe her as being, you know, somebody extremely in touch with their emotions, and I just wonder, can she turn it off as well as she can turn it on? I mean, like you as an ethnographer, you know, have to you be sensitive, but also sort of channel things through the ethnographer. Does she do that as an artist in some ways, would you say?
Well, I mean, she's highly performative, so I can't really determine whether she's in touch with her own emotions or not, but she can perform her emotions, and she is, like, well-known as someone who cries in public and cries during giving her talks and in a lot of her performances. And you know, sobbing is certainly something... Sobbing in public is a taboo, and one that she has found useful in her performances in various ways. I think that you know, we all do better, whether we're artists or ethnographers, if we're emotionally literate. You know, and not sweeping things under the carpet,
right,
kind of
well
bringing
said
them out into the open.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that Laurie Simmons says that is one of my favorite lines in the whole book, and because I'm really interested in confidence and credibility and artist self-belief and how they engender, you know, self-belief in themselves, in others. And she says something really great about self-belief, and let me see if I can find it, because I think it's one of those bits that I've underlined.
Okay.
Yeah, she says, when you are younger, you think about eradicating self-doubt. But as you age, you understand that it is part of the rhythm of being an artist. As I get older, I have developed my ability to examine self-doubt in private, to play around with it rather than push it away. See, I think that is, like, just a great thought for anybody.
It is.
Who needs to pull themselves together and get on with their job, whatever it is, writing a book, researching a story, making an artwork, trying to find a dealer. You know, anyone who's a self-starter, who's faced with the doubt of others or self-doubt in any way, shape, or form. It is not like all of a sudden, you know, you're showing with David Zwirner, you have no more self-doubt, you know?
Right.
It's not like that.
Right.
And actually, that's definitely something I felt with all of my most senior artists, which is something for younger artists to keep in mind, is that, you know, they also experience self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
They just have a lot of different strategies for dealing with it.
Yeah.
Which means, you know, the way they go about researching the next work or thinking about the next work or the way they manage their day at the studio.
Mm-hmm,
you know, if
mm-hmm.
they're having a day of self-doubt, it's maybe not the day to start that new work. It's the one to, like, you know, finish the polishing on something else. You know, and...
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that quote in, because since I didn't have that in my list, that's a really good one. There are two quick things that I want to get to, because I know we're almost out of time for you. One of them is, and we can go through these pretty quickly, one is, I'm wondering to what extent you have been aware of the critical reception to both books, particularly the latter book, because I know that it has received some criticism, at least in some elements of the dialogue.
You know, let's see, 33 Artists and Three Acts has received less press than 7 Days in the Art World, and I think that's because it doesn't overtly deal with the market. 7 Days in the Art World has a chapter called The Auction, one called The Fair, and in the U.S., it was launched in November during auction season.
Mm.
It got a lot more press, a lot more radio, and a lot more reviews.
Right.
Internationally, it got more scathing reviews than it got very positive reviews and more scathing reviews than 33 Artists and Three Acts. 33 Artists and Three Acts has, had. I don't know which review are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of the Village Voice Christian Viveros Fone review. Did you happen to see that or hear about it?
You know what? I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it had a great review in the LA Times, a great review in the Washington Post, a great review in San Francisco Chronicle. It had, unfortunately, it did not get a full review in the New York Times. It was kind of a part of a roundup of five different art-related books by a reviewer who's not really an art person.
Mm.
And so it had, like, I don't know, two paragraphs, which were not critical, but, you know, but not necessarily getting it, you know?
Right.
So, I think, you know, you can have all sorts of, like, arguments about, who should have been in the book, who shouldn't have been in the book, why didn't I get access to so-and-so. I mean, my feeling is that I did interviews with 130 different artists and cherry-picked 29 to be in the book. There are actually only 29 artists, rather than 33.
Mm-hmm.
And my alibi there is somewhat jokingly, Gertrude Stein wrote a libretto called Four Saints and Three Acts, and there are actually over 20 saints in there, so she can
right.
fudge her numbers. So
right.
can I. You know, and I cherry-picked the artists who were most revealing about the question, what is an artist?
Ah.
That was my dominant criteria. So it privileges artists who are dealing with the question, what is an artist, in their work,
mm.
playing around with their identity in
mm-hmm.
their work.
Mm-hmm.
40% of the artists in the book are female, and I at one point thought it might have been nice to have 50%, but... I didn't want to push it into the realms of tokenism, and I always wanted to go with the best material so that, you know, there was never a scene or chapter in the book that felt like it wasn't fully pulling its weight. The book is put together like a puzzle. I'm a structure fetishist. I always like the structure of 7 Days in the Art World, and with this book, each act starts in summer 2009 and rolls through to the present.
Mm.
And I needed to have, you know, sometimes I'd have a really interesting artist, but I'd catch them at the wrong time and they didn't fit into my timeline,
mm.
or it was the wrong moment in their career or trajectory to offer something different, and I already had something that was too similar, or that kind of thing. So...
Okay.
Yeah.
That all sounds good.
So, I mean, I think actually, you know, it's much more ambitious than a series of profiles, and
sure.
And it is something that hasn't been done to compare and contrast artists in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And it there the book has an ambition that exceeds a lot of art critics. To be honest, in terms of what they're willing to take on as a research project. I mean, some of our best art critics who are amazing writers and really insightful when it comes to artwork don't really like to write more than 2,000 words at a time.
Right.
You know, and wouldn't want to take on a project like this that required wielding so much research and so much looking outside the frame, because it gets very complicated and difficult.
Was it exhausting?
Oh my God, yeah. I was
absolutely.
So burnt out afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm still getting back on my feet, to
right.
be honest.
Wow. Well, before we run out of time, I wanted to, since we are about out of time, I at least want to squeeze this in. The Crit, which is chapter 2, is it, in 7 days?
Yes, it
which
is.
Takes place at CalArts.
Yep.
I actually know at least one, if not more, of those artists who are in that class, and so
yeah.
I think we're going to do a little mini reunion
Oh, how fun.
Yeah. And so if you highly particularly recommend, like, for example, the asshole in the class and the artists that show their work, I mean, would you recommend those people? If we had just three or four or five people, which of those members of the class would you recommend?
Well, I'm trying to remember who the asshole is in the class.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say anyone's an asshole, but there is that guy who's kind of like grandstanding.
Grandstanding guy, yeah.
Yeah, the grandstanding guy. The guy, he's kind of like, you know, feels like he knows more than the rest at that stage.
Right.
So you want to do a reunion with them
a podcast with them. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would definitely try to include the artist who presented that day.
Okay.
So I think Fiona Jack,
mm-hmm,
and Josh Stone,
mm-hmm,
and
She's
in New Zealand.
Hobbs.
Hobbs, exactly. Rebecca Hobbs. I would definitely try to include them.
Great.
It's a shame Michael's no longer with us.
Yeah.
He was wonderful to work with.
Yeah.
Slasher.
Okay.
Well,
Phil Chang is my contact.
Oh, yeah, Phil. Oh, you know, and Nate Harrison.
Okay.
Nate Harrison and Kim Schoen.
Is there anything, Sarah, that, I mean, believe me, we could easily go on another hour or at least a half hour, but I know time-wise and maybe listener-wise, we're good for now. But is there anything in particular that I left out that you want me to ask you about or you want to just say?
I mean, it's interesting that you wanted to focus very much on Koons and Hurst in our conversation, because that is presumably what the guy from the Village Voice was most objected to. But I found that people who object to that then also want to focus on it, and that's an interesting
dynamic. It's true, but it's not my objection. Those just happened to be memorable moments that I started with, and I guess, you know, relative to the whole portion of our time, we spent a disproportionate amount of time on them, maybe. But, you know, I think it's something that people are curious about as well. It's certainly people are curious about Andrea Frazier, and we could have spent a lot more time on her, but, you know, that's just kind of the way things unfold sometimes. It's not in either of our controls in some ways.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried. Well,
it's been a pleasure, and I really appreciate you you taking the time to talk to me, Sarah.
Well, thank you for taking the time.
And we're out. And there you have it. Thank you very much again to Sarah Thornton for talking to me. Was that a bit of an abrupt ending there after all that? We took quite a ride, I think. Now, my fantasy, I didn't want to mention this at the beginning, is that we get Christian Viveros-Fonet of the Village Voice and Sarah Thornton and I together to do a podcast. I think that's just going to be a fantasy. But Sarah, if you're listening, is that something you'd be open to? And if so, I will broach the subject with Christian Viveros-Fonet, see what we can work out, have a little conversation about the art world and how to report it, if you will. If you haven't read the books, please read them or listen to them before you go and read the reviews. I actually had read the review in the Village Voice that Christian wrote well before I read the books. And fortunately, I was able to put it out of my mind / forget about it by the time I listened to the book, so I wasn't overly influenced. And as you noticed, I did refer to it towards the end of the conversation, and I couldn't remember what the primary objectives against them or against 33 artists was. So that sort of part of the conversation went out onto the editing floor. But anyway, I think that's an interesting angle to consider. Finally, before we go, I want to remind you that you can support the show other than financially by becoming a fan on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show on iTunes. That's a way to help bump the ratings, and you can also leave a nice review there if you like what you're hearing. And another thing you can do is you can take your friend's phone, smartphone,
or tablet or what have you, and you can subscribe either on iTunes or, you know, another device, another platform, Stitcher, etc. There are others, I believe. I think that's about it. Finally, do let us know what you think of this episode. Indeed, did I not ask any of the right questions, or did I leave out some important questions that you wanted me to ask Sarah Thornton with this rare opportunity? And if so, you know, do email, post, get a little dialogue, post this conversation going. And maybe we can take them up with a follow-up conversation. Oh, and yeah, hopefully Phil Chang, as you heard mentioned towards the end, will help us engineer this reunion with the CalArts class that is investigated thoroughly in the second chapter of her first book, 7 Days in the Art World, called The Crit. So I hope we can put that together, and I will keep you posted, of course. Thank you very much again for being here. I appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed. Let us know what you think. And I will talk to you soon.